This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's time to check with Indiana political analyst Brian Howey for the latest on not only a little bit of action from the General Assembly. They're still working down there in Indianapolis these days, and also, too, on Hoosier politics. Brian, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Always a pleasure.
Well, let's take up the legislature first. We know that there's still a lot of discussion that's underway, and some of it kind of bleeds over into the other side of politics as to whether anything will ever come out from this General Assembly session on the so-called hate crimes issue or bias issue, I guess, depending on how you want to put it. What's the latest that you hear?
Well, you know, the thing is languishing. I don't think it's going to get a hearing until next week, I think on Wednesday, and time is kind of running out. It's got a clear, it's got to be, I guess, on the floor and passed the House by April 9th in order to get into the conference committee schedule. Mm-hmm. So the time's running out. It was interesting. Governor Holcomb came back from Europe. He wants the list restored to Senate Bill 12. He said he was going to be very vocal about it. And then in his first public appearance, before the Madison County Republican Party Lincoln Dinner in Anderson on Saturday, he didn't even bring it up. He talked about First Dog Henry Holcomb and some other things.
It shows his priorities there, you know. So.
Well, now, Speaker Brian Bosma was saying that, you know, they're in discussion, so maybe the governor doesn't want to use the bully pulpit at this point. Maybe they're having some back-channel discussions, and Bosma was saying, told our correspondent Jacob Curry down at the State House that they're trying to see what would go and whether they can avoid having this issue linger through next session, which of course is 2020, which of course is an election year. So the other thing about that is there's not a Democrat surfacing to run for governor yet. I mean, usually by this time, 14 months away from the primary, you've got somebody, you know, out there, somebody who's a front runner, out there raising money, you know, appearing at Jefferson Jackson dinners and that kind of thing, and there's nobody. Matter of fact, I posted an old Gary Barbell cartoon, you know, with John Gregg on the milk cart saying, you know, have you seen this man, you know? So I'm not sure Holcomb is going to feel a lot of political pressure on this thing. Going to be fascinating to see, you know, because he said he was going to be very outspoken about it and everything, and right now he's not.
So you get the impression that unless there is a Democratic gubernatorial candidate who's in the wings and is out there, as you say, really stumping it, looking for support, that he's not going to feel any pressure at all to step up and talk out like he has said so far that he would do.
Well, I actually think, you know, without an opponent lining up for Holcomb. And again, at some point, they'll slot somebody in there. But I actually think it may be legislators that may feel a little more heat. You've got several suburban districts, including Speaker Bosma's district. I think he probably had one of his narrowest re-election bids last November against a gal named Poonam Gill, who, you know, impressed a lot of people. I think she had something like 45% of the vote, and you have that a rematch in that race with the, you know, a Democratic turnout in a presidential year, and so actually the heat may be felt in some of the legislative races as opposed to the governor's race.
Besides the talk or non-talk, whichever the case may be, about hate crime / bias and what may come from the legislature about this, they're still dealing with the budget, and I guess now it is in the hands of the Indiana Senate to take up the issue. Is there anything that you're aware of, or are we just going to watch that kind of move along through the rest of March and into April and get closer and closer to the end of the session?
Yeah, I think things seem to be on track. The governor is going to get the money that he wanted for the Department of Child Services. They seem to have the school safety money lined up. And, you know, the big thing there is how they handle the teacher pay issue. And again, when the governor was in Anderson over the weekend, you know, he's still sticking to what his 2-year plan, which is they're going to cut some slack for the school corporation with the teacher retirement fund, and they're hoping that the school corporations won't have to spend those funds on that. They can spend it on teacher raise. And then I think that we'll see the state maybe do something more on teacher pay in the 2020 session. Of course, that's a short session. It's not a budget session.
Right.
So, and of course, you know, I hear Ways and Means Chairman Tim Brown, you know, come out and say, well, it's actually up to the local schools, school boards to determine the teacher pay. He doesn't think that really it's a state function. So, you know, the governor seems to be sticking to his 2 to 3 year plan on that.
Besides dealing with issues about hate crime and about the budgets, of course, I know there are a number of other things that are coming up, and a lot of them are not, I guess, real bold topics that the General Assembly at least is bringing up now. But we know that there has been some discussion about various things, and I think some of them, of course, have now kind of been blended into the 2 year budget proposal. I know one of the things that had come up earlier was the efforts that Indiana's mass transit lobbyists, to speak of, mainly the folks that are with the Passenger Rail Alliance, wanted to do to make sure that the Amtrak, Hoosier State, and the other lines running through Indiana still get the funding to keep going. And now it doesn't seem like that's in the budget any longer. So does it look like maybe that somebody's going to step up and champion the effort?
I just haven't really heard yeah. much of that. And I think the big news on the mass transit front is the federal money that Representative Bisklosky announced this past week for the South Shore line. And if you listen to the South Shore and regional officials up there, they think that that expansion of the South Shore, you know, which will allow more commuters to get into Chicago, they seem to think that process is going very well. Mm-hmm. So that's the big thing. And then we've got the Red Line here in Indianapolis that's under construction. That's where most of the talk is. I'm just not hearing a lot of buzz about keeping that Amtrak line funded through the state budget.
I know that you've spent quite a bit of time in doing research and all, and have turned out the columns in Howie Politics Indiana about this. In fact, one of them as recently as this past weekend here, talking about, I guess, what the national political picture is going to shape up like. And you talked about, I guess, in the Saturday column that you had about at least what and this goes back, I think, to what you mentioned from the Indiana Republican Party spring dinner here, and what people seem to think about what the case may be in national politics. But you've kind of referred to Monty Python's Flying Circus it's the line that really that kind of John Cleese would use, always, at least it started out some of the programs, was and now for something completely different. Does that seem to be the case as the way it shapes up now, and even with President Trump in office?
Well, the now for something completely different is we had Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bozzi, who are, you know, two of the ultimate Trump insiders. They gave a kind of a Q&A before the spring dinner last week, and they threw out some red meat. One of the more interesting things is they want the Mueller report released. I think it's going to vindicate President Trump, and they're going to throw chaos into the race. They're going to attack whoever the Democrat nominee is. And, of course, we have no idea who that's going to be. I think that race is wide open. But, you know, one thing I can tell you is the 2020 race is just going to be a real Donnybrook. Now, the one thing that could upend that is the Mueller report. And we'll have to see, you know, what that says about President Trump. And I think that's what all of Washington and a lot of us here in Indiana are waiting for. And you know what, Chris? I don't even want to speculate on what that thing's going to hold. Nobody really has any idea other than Robert Mueller and his team. And so to speculate at this point, you know, I think is fool's errand. We're just going to have to wait and see what comes out. But that's the one thing that could really change everything.
And also, I mean, you know, I was looking at just checking over some of the other items that you mentioned in the columns that you had here talking about this. And where does our former governor seem to fit into all of this? Now vice president, of course, Mike Pence. I've heard even up as early as today that there are some people that are thinking that maybe that somebody else ought to be, at least when it comes time to putting him up on the platform and on the ballot, that someone else other than Mike Pence ought to be put in place for vice president.
Well, it was interesting. I was at an Indiana Policy Review dinner on Friday. That's the organization that Mike Pence headed back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And there's an Indianapolis attorney and a former aide to Richard Nixon, Tom Houston, who came out and said, well, you know, if I had to advise President Trump, I'd put Nikki Haley on the ticket and not Pence. He doesn't think Pence really brings anything to the ticket. You've heard a little bit of that in the national press, although, you know, a day or so after the November election, you know, Trump said, we don't know if he was kidding or not, that he was going to keep, ask Pence, literally, will you be on the ticket with me? I think that's the presumption. Now, if Trump ends up in deep water, if his Republican support collapses because of the Mueller report, and again, that's sheer speculation. I'm not predicting that at this point, but obviously Mike Pence would be the go-to guy if for some reason President Trump's political station, you know, became untenable. But having said that, you know, I think there'd be a lot of people that would take a long, hard look at Nikki Haley, too, the former South Carolina and United Nations ambassador. But boy, Chris, we're really getting way ahead of ourselves.
Yeah,
on
that's
that
true.
Front,
that's true.
Know?
That's true.
You know, well, and let's see what happens.
Well, and you mentioned, and also too, thinking about some comments here about Mike Pence here. Some of the latest ones also came from a person who's interested in running for president, and of course, it's Pete Buttigieg. He had some interesting comments, I guess, on one of the talk shows, didn't he?
Well, Pete is interesting. He's just now, you know, peeking up in a poll in Iowa, and then there's another one in Wisconsin where he was at 1%. But as he's made the rounds on the talk shows, he's done Colbert. He's going to be on MSNBC's Morning Joe tomorrow morning. He's impressed a lot of people. He's got some pretty good policy chops. He talks about policy very fluently and very progressively. And I think a lot of people are going to take another long, hard look at him. You know, I've seen polling that, you know, shows that Democrats, you know, they don't want a septuagenarian such as Bernie Sanders or Biden on the ticket. If you look at the history of the Democratic Party, the presidents that they've we've had over the past, you know, 50, 60 years, you know, JFK, I think, was 43. Obama was 47, Clinton was 42, even LBJ was only 55 years old when he was elected. They tend to go for a younger character. Here we've got Pete Buttigieg at 37. You've got a number of others in the field that are in their 40s. So to me, that's going to be something really interesting to watch, is whether somebody as old as Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden, you know, and I think Biden's, what, going to be 78 if he were to be elected, and Bernie's close to that, whether they are truly the future of the party.
Well, you even go back to one of your columns that you had back in December of last year, talking about the possibility, at least back then, of there possibly being a President Buttigieg. And I guess if things have happened, things can happen in politics. It's very likely that somebody will push that idea forth, I'm sure.
Well, you know, again, I think I brought this up before when we've talked, but, you know, throughout the past couple of years, and, you know, I finished a number of columns by saying anything can happen. Here in the age of Trump, you know, we obviously saw that with Donald Trump being elected president. You know, President Buttigieg, a gay mayor from South Bend, Indiana, it sounds kind of fantastic, but given the recent events,
yeah,
you really can't rule it out. Yeah, I think the Democratic presidential race is absolutely wide open. Joe Biden's going to get in. There's been speculation on some of the shows today that he might come out with a ticket, you know, maybe announce with Stacey Abrams, who lost a Georgia gubernatorial race. She's an African-American candidate who actually, you know, did pretty well, but she didn't win. So there's talk that, you know, Biden may try to match up with a younger person and run as a ticket right off the bat. We'll have to wait and see. Again, that's speculative too.
Well, Brian, the only thing I can add, I guess, to the national political scene is something that I observed here in looking at Highway Politics Indiana, and the comments that you had online and that had out there for the subscribers to the newsletter on Saturday. It goes back to the dinner that you were talking about with Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bossy, and the two thumbnail pictures that are on the story look scarily like two other people from a previous White House regime that you can certainly understand and take appreciation with, people like Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman. They do look very scarily alike, don't they?
I hadn't thought of that.
You don't have to squint. You don't have to squint your eyes too hard to think of that. That's to be sure.
Those guys were throwing the red meat out the other day, and again, if they're in a position to run the campaign for Donald Trump, it's going to be a tingler.
Yes, to be sure. One last comment.
Go to the kitchen sink in,
One last comment I'd like to get briefly here, too. And, in fact, your last Howie Politics Indiana edition talked with a front-page story and all, and in much more detail inside, kind of talking about the situation that Indiana journalism is going through these days, and in particular the print media here. Give us just a thumbnail sketch as to what you had to say and the concern that you and a lot of other political observers might really have about the fact that there are so few voices out there compared to what there used to be.
Yeah, when I first started publishing Howie Politics back in 1994, I think there were about 20 or 25, political columnists around the state. There's only a handful of us now. I still run Rich James in Howie Politics. Mm-hmm. The region's lucky to have a great newspaper like the Times and people like Mark Chase that are still writing, but the ranks have really thinned out down the state. You've seen a lot of the local newspapers really shrivel up as the family newspapers have sold to some of the chains. And I think it's really starting to dawn on people now, beyond the Times circulation area, that journalism's in atrophy. If you look at the Indianapolis Star and the Muncie Star Press and the Evansville Courier and Press, I mean, these were once great newspapers, and they're just a shell of their former selves. I know there's a lot of conversation going on in a lot of circles about where we go from here. There's been talk about establishing a 501c3 news foundation. There's just a lot of people talking about this across the state. So stay tuned. I think there's going to be some interesting developments, but we've got to figure out a financial platform for 21st century media and then try to execute it. I'm certainly going to play a significant role in that. One of the things that Howie Politics is still here is, we put a paywall up and we didn't take it down, and we've survived, like newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, but a lot of others didn't do that, and they're in real trouble. I mean, we've seen like a 45% decline in number of newsroom personnel over the past decade, and we've had something like 1,300 to 1,400 newspapers close around the country. That's a crisis. And if you think about the meth crisis, the heroin crisis, a lot of that happened because the local press wasn't there. They didn't flag this stuff when it was first starting, 5 or 6 years ago, and it really mushroomed into now it's tens and tens of billions of dollars that it's going to take to solve it. So the press has got to reinvigorate itself. And that process, I think, is just now starting.
Well, Brian, we'll have to leave it at that, and we'll have this conversation again soon. And we hope. And thank you for being with us today for the updates on Hoosier politics and national politics as well, too. And
if I could say one more thing, though. We'll soon hear about the funeral services for the late Senator Birchbuy.
Yeah.
It's truly great. I think you're going to be hearing more about that. We don't know when that funeral is going to be, so you might keep an eye on that.
We'll do.
In the next couple of days.
We'll be looking forward to it. And Brian, thanks for being with us today to talk about the topics today. Indiana political analyst Brian Howie, who puts out Howie Politics Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The first neighborhood that I remember growing up in was on the east side of Gary, on Massachusetts Street. And my parents brought me home from the hospital there, and I lived there until I was four and a half, just about 5 years old. And it was a very tight-knit community. I remember the families all interacted. The other thing about the neighborhood I remember, there were people from all walks of lives. My dad was a teacher. Across the street, my mother's best friend was my physician. We had other teachers on the block. We had people that worked in the steel mill. And all of us lived in one community. And that allowed, I think, growing up, people to see that all of these things were attainable. I think that's part of what doesn't happen today. Because once people get to a certain financial level, they tend to move away from the original community. I've never used that term, black flight, but I think there are a lot of things involved with that. Certainly people have a tendency, if they make a certain amount of money, to want to live in a different home. In this area, there are nice, beautiful homes in different sections of Gary and Miller, for instance. Even on the west side of Gary, there are some beautiful homes, but a lot of times people have felt like they want to live in another community. I think the media has played a big role in that because they have demonized this community for so long that people bought into this notion that no one wants to live in Gary and that Gary is unsafe and this is not somewhere that you would want to live. And particularly if you've gotten to the point where you want to have put a lot of money into a home, you would not want to put that money into Gary. And then, of course, we have to discuss the crime. But the crime is associated to the jobs. And so when you take jobs out of a community and you replace those jobs with guns and money, then you have something that's volatile. And as a result, then you start to, you know, have these notions that I can't live a safe life. I think the white flight really is based on racism, purely racism. I don't care that I live in a nice home. I don't care what the community looks like, if it's predominantly black or if there's even some blacks. I would prefer not to live there and or do business there. And that is what really has happened to Gary, Indiana.
I was born and raised in Gary, Indiana. I grew up on the west side of town on Clinton Street, two blocks from Westside High School. You know, when I left the house that morning, I was at school the entire day. I went to school at 7 in the morning because I was an ROTC, drill team member, and I was a commander as my senior year. So I was there at 7 o'clock for drill team practice. Left from there, go to class. After class, during football season, football practice. Then after football practice, I went to karate class. So by the time I got home, it was like 7:30 o'clock. So I did get home in time to do homework, my chores, which was wash dishes, or if it's my brother's week, he'd wash dishes and I would clean up the basement. Now over the summer, you're up, you went around the neighborhood, you played sports, you rode your bike. It was safe to ride your bike back then. But when them street lights came on, you had to be in the house or you had to be anywhere in distance where you can hear your mother calling you. That's the thing. We didn't have cell phones and all that back then. You had to listen to your voice or your mom because you could be blocks away and you hear your name. And you knew that was the time that, hey, I need to get home. And your friends did too. So you could see us all flying home on our bikes because we knew those street lights come on. We had to be in the house. When I came through, you had all five schools. You had Westside, Horseman, Wirt, New Wallace, and Roosevelt. And each of them had a ROTC program. Each year in March, we would have the citywide competition, and the whole city is inside Westside Gym. I mean, it's from the floor all the way up to the ceilings on the second floor is how it used to be. Like the Super Bowl for high school, who has the bragging rights to be called the number one drill team in the city. As the schools close and as the program withered away, it's not as a big deal like it used to be. We had recreation every summer. We had arts and craft at one point, learned geography at another class area. We had basketball. We had all kind of other stuff to do during the summer. And we ate lunch there amongst each other. Parents was working 8 to 4. So between the first hour they're gone, we're at home. the last hour that before they come home, we're back at home, but they know those 6 hours, hey, they at recreation. And we had people who lived in the neighborhood, might have worked evenings or nights, that kept an eye on us. Hey, I got your son, he's here at my house, don't have to worry about nothing. We was disciplined by everyone. You know, we just couldn't just say, well, my mom this, my mom that. Now, if I did it with my neighbor, then that neighbor parent got a chance to correct both of us if we was wrong. And then my mother would say that too. If you did it with them, then you deserve the punishment with them. That's just how it was done back then when I grew up, because it takes everybody to teach someone how to be. It's just not just one person or that one family. It's your neighborhood that you grew up, that you respected. That's where it comes from, like the village raising each other, because we had the aspect of being safe. We had to worry about, okay, if we go next door, this gonna happen or that gonna happen. We believed in everybody and they believed in us and they helped raise us. As we then got older as adults, we have forgotten where we came from. In order to make our kids better, we have to provide these things for them. But a lot of us have moved on and moved away, so we're taking them things to other areas. I see a lot lacking. It's because no one wants to come here and put in the work or the effort or the money into this for some reason. I don't know why, but I mean, if I'd had the chance, I would, because we have a lot of kids who don't know that we had Beattie basketball everywhere, who don't know we had Little League baseball here and there, who don't know that we had 3-4 Pop Warner teams. It gave us, as we were growing up, something to do besides standing in the streets, hanging on the corner, or at home just playing Xbox or PlayStation all the time. We had something to do.
And you can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Coming up on March 21st, the Avalon Manor in Hobart will be once again the place for the annual Diversity and Inclusion Awards. It's a luncheon, and this year this will be the seventh annual such event. It's put on by the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, and we have with us to talk about it the president and CEO of the Urban League, Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod. And Dr. Allen McLeod, thanks for being with us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I know that we've talked before about this many times, several times here, certainly in the years past, but there has to be somebody that comes new into the community, is not familiar with, first off, what the Urban League does here in Northwest Indiana, and secondly, the little history lesson I guess we could get from creating this annual Diversity and Inclusion Awards. Will you take us into that, please?
Yes. The Urban League of Northwest Indiana serves Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties in the areas of education, financial stability, and diversity and inclusion. So, for instance, under the heading of education, we offer scholarships to high school graduating seniors anywhere from $250 all the way up to $2,500. We have several donors that provide money for scholarships for students in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties. We also have a large annual scholarship fair every September where we have about 60 or 70 colleges and universities that will come to the area, and they admit students on the spot, and they offer partial or full ride scholarships to any Lake, Porter, and LaPorte County student. In fact, this last year we offered $4.7 million in scholarships. That is up from the year before when we offered $2.7 million. In terms of financial literacy, many people come to our office to have their income taxes processed. We're part of the VITA program, which is called the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. So we provide tax service free of charge so that people don't have to go to Uncle Sam or Quickie Sam or whoever that's going to take their money. So we will continue to do that. And then that leads up to our Diversity and Inclusion Awards Luncheon that's coming up on March 21st. We're going to have a number of business and community leaders as well as students come, and we're going to acknowledge those organizations that have submitted applications towards our awards. People, organizations like Ameristar will be receiving an award. The Indiana University Northwest Police Department will be receiving an award. Community Health Net, and the top winner of all of this is called the Moving the Needle Award, mm-hmm. which is sponsored by NIPSCO. The Moving the Needle Award goes to Strike and Van Til, and I'm sure many of us are familiar with the good work that they do throughout Northwest Indiana. So those are a few of the highlights that's coming up. But one of the main highlights, of course, is Senator Earlene Rogers will be presented the Lifetime Award. And we are very excited about giving her the Lifetime Award with all of the work that she has done, not just here locally, but throughout the state. She's been retired, I believe, maybe 2 years.
Yeah, not very long.
Not very long at all. She's been retired, but she was a part of the Senate for over 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, she was retired from the school. So she's just done a lot of work in our area. And another person that's going to receive the Minority Business Award is Robert E. Johnson III. And he is the founder and president of an organization called SEMCOR. It's an organization, a business that he has that deals with intelligence and security and cyber security, things like that. So he's been around. And in fact, Robert has served as the Legacy Foundation's board chair. So we're looking for at least, well, should I say, we have registered already 550 people mm-hmm. at the Avalon, so we may have to knock out a wall or something.
Well, be sure you get permission from the folks at Avalon Manor first. I'm sure they'll be happy. They'll be happy to shift some folks around if they have to. You don't have to be such a drastic move. But yeah, you want to get them all in. That's the idea, is that they will have all these people that will want to participate and be around to not only have a lunch, but also to honor all of these people involved. How do these folks and organizations get chosen? Or nominated, I should say, because I know it's a competition in a way. How do they get nominated for these various awards?
Well, actually, they can self-nominate, or someone within the company or organization can complete the application, which we have online. We always have that application online. And in November, we have a symposium. We have a symposium at Valparaiso University, where we go over the application process. So applications come into our office, they're submitted online, and then we have a diversity and inclusion committee that reviews those applications. People like Taggy Oshami from the Arsh Corporation, Dave Darling, who is retired chief of police from Sherrillville, several people are on that committee. Danny Lackey from the Mirrorville Schools. Several people are on the committee to review those applications. And from there, the winners are selected.
And one of the opportunities here to learn about how the community really works is to be able to be participants in programs in such as helping set up this luncheon, I'm sure, with the Urban League and the like. And you probably find there are a lot of community members that have no doubt, if they haven't already, learned a lot about the mission of the Urban League, probably just by participating in helping set these programs up.
Oh, absolutely. We try to explain and express to people that our mission has not changed from 100 years ago. Many people don't know that the Urban League was founded by a retired railroad widow. She was a Caucasian woman, and there was a Black man, and both of them were the originators of the Urban League. Many people don't know that. So our organization began with Ruth Baldwin and Fred Haynes back in the 1900s. Can you believe that?
Wow.
We've always been an interracial organization, and some people don't know that. So we started the organization, just like the NAACP started years ago, to assist African Americans as they migrated from the South to the North. They helped them find housing, education, and give them a better quality of life. Well, we're still doing the same things now. However, we've just reached out to everyone because everyone needs an opportunity to live and recreate where they want to be. And sometimes that's not able, that's not available to them. So the Urban League is still doing the same thing through education and housing, job opportunities that are listed on our website. So sometimes people can look back on the TV and look at some of the historical accounts and they'll see the marching. Well, NAACP was on the front line marching, whereas the Urban League was behind the scenes helping people, teaching people how to type, teaching people how to put their resume together, things like that. So I hope that's given you a little information on our beginning and our purpose and our continued mission.
Well, we certainly appreciate the information, and we thank you very much for helping us out and explaining not only the mission of the Urban League here for Northwest Indiana, but to talk more about how people get involved in the annual Diversity and Inclusion Awards Luncheon. Once again, the luncheon's coming up on March 21st. It'll be held at the Avalon Manor, which is along U.S. 30 in Hobart, and we're expecting more than 500 people to show up. It's going to be quite an audience that's going to get involved in thanking all of these people, the nonprofits, the businesses, the civic groups, the educational organizations that have shown their commitment to diversity all across Northwest Indiana. And Dr. Alan McLeod, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Dr. Vanessa Alan McLeod is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. Well, we're past winter time when it's probably a wise idea to let your faucets drip a little bit so the pipes don't freeze at your home or your apartment, but it's not that time any longer, and now, as a matter of fact, it's wise to fix those leaks that may happen to come because this is Fix a Leak Week here in Indiana. We find out more here by talking with Anthony Swinger. He's with the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor, and we have some other information we'll pass along as well, too. Anthony, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today to talk about Fix a Leak Week.
Hey, my pleasure, Chris.
Well, this is planned this way. It's not just happened to be an idea that maybe because it's not winter and we don't have to have these intentional leaks, that it's a good idea to fix those leaky pipes and leaky faucets. Tell us how this all came about.
Fix a Leak Week is a national campaign. It's been around for more than a decade, and it's a collaborative effort of the water utility industry, plumbing companies, other companies whose businesses deal with water, consumer advocates, federal and state regulators, local governments. It is really a large, large group that promotes this every year. It's really coordinated through the EPA, through its WaterSense campaign. But every year, we take the opportunity at this point during the year to promote Fix a Leak Week. It's just a good annual reminder for folks to be aware of water leaks, to understand that even if it's a tiny leak, it may be costing you a lot more money than you realize. And there are three main areas we recommend people check just to make sure that you're on the safe side.
All right. What are these ways that we can all check our faucets at home or where we live to make sure that we're not only wasting money too?
Exactly. Well, the first is the most obvious and the easiest, and that's checking all the faucets in the home or business to make sure they're not dripping. And if they are dripping, in most cases, the repairs are not expensive at all. Keep in mind that if a faucet is dripping twice per second and it goes unrepaired for a month, it'll waste almost 520 gallons of water. That's about a tenth of an average customer's residential monthly usage. So even though it's just a drip here and a drip there, those drips add up, and they can add up a lot more quickly than folks realize. If you have the same faucet, it's dripping twice per second, and you let it go unrepaired for a year, then you're talking well over 6,000 gallons that have been wasted, and therefore more than 6,000 gallons of water you've paid for but you haven't used.
Now, it's even worse, I guess, if you have a leaky flapper on your toilet tank, isn't it?
Absolutely. A toilet leak can waste hundreds of gallons every day, and that's another thing that a lot of folks don't realize. If you have a toilet that's especially an older one, it's a good idea to do a quick test on it and make sure you don't have a leak going from the tank into the bowl. The easiest thing to do is take a little bit of food coloring, just a few drops, drop them in the toilet tank, and then wait about 20 to 25 minutes. Don't flush the toilet. After about 20 to 25 minutes, look in the bowl. If you see any food coloring in the bowl, that means you have a leak. That means you need to do something to the toilet to stop that from happening. And it may be as simple as buying a new flapper that costs less than $10 and can be a very easy fix. Of course, after you do that, it's important to flush the toilet right away. That way, the food coloring does not hang around and cause stains.
Mm-hmm. And also, too, I guess it's wise to check at home or maybe even a business for an invisible water leak. What are those and why are they so important to check out?
When we talk about invisible leaks, we're mainly talking about a leak you can get in the underground supply line. That's the line that connects the utility's main to the building. In most cases, the utility is responsible for the part of the supply line that goes from its main to your meter. But anything between the meter and your building is the homeowner's responsibility or the customer's responsibility. And if you have a crack or even a small hole in an underground supply line, that too can leak a considerable amount of water. Mm-hmm. The best way to check for that is turn off all the faucets and appliances in your home that use water. Make sure everything's completely off. Read your water meter. Don't use any water for at least a half hour. Then check the meter again. If you see no movement, then you're good. If you see some movement, then that would indicate that something's going on and you need to look into it further.
Now, how easy is it to be able to read your service meter, I guess, that the water company provides for you? Because we have all these electronic reading devices now. In fact, I know that, for example, Indiana American Water Company is set up, and a lot of utilities do, where they can come along with the truck and actually read your meter. So that's how your water service gets checked. How easy is it for you to be able to have access to your meter these days?
You may need to get a special wrench in order to get into the meter pit, and you may want to check with the utility regarding any guidelines for that. Of course, tampering with a meter is against the law. It's against IURC rules and can result in, you know, being shut off. So by no means would we encourage anyone to tamper or try to manipulate the meter in any way. But if you're simply going to open the pit and take a look at what's on the numbers, what's on the dials, that's perfectly fine. As you just mentioned, there are new electronic meters that many utilities are switching to. Obviously, that makes it very, very easy to read them. If you have an older meter, it may have a dial. It may have what looks like a car odometer in it. If you have such a meter and you're not quite sure how to read it or what it says, the best thing to do is call the utility because the utility can tell you exactly what type of meter you have. I know that there are a number of water utilities that even on their websites have a quick guide or an overview on how to read one of the older water meters that may have a dial or dials on it.
And if you'd like more information here about Fix a Leak Week, how can you get it?
We have information on our website at www.in.gov/OUCC. If you don't have internet access and you'd like a copy of our tips by mail, just feel free to call us toll-free at 1-888-441-2494, and we'll be glad to get those to you.
We're talking with Anthony Swinger, who's a spokesperson for the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor, and we understand there's a new development come out here, I guess a settlement between the OUCC and a major Northwest Indiana water supplier. Tell us about that.
Yesterday evening, we reached and filed a settlement agreement with Indiana American Water Company and the additional parties in the rate case as well. We've reached a comprehensive settlement agreement in the rate case, and it's been filed with the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission. The IURC can ultimately accept, deny, or modify any agreement that's filed before it. But the bottom line is this settlement, if approved, would provide roughly half the increase that the utilities requested. It would resolve all issues pertaining to federal tax relief and making sure that those dollars are shared with customers. And it also includes a low-income pilot program, with an even balance of funding from ratepayers and shareholders. Those are the terms of the agreement, and again, it's been filed with the commission. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that in addition to the OUCC, there are additional parties that are on the agreement. They include the Citizens Action Coalition, the Indiana Community Action Association, several industrial customers, and several municipal governments that buy wholesale water from Indiana American.
Now, if the URC happens to approve this, what's this going to mean for Northwest Indiana water consumers?
We're still crunching the numbers to get an exact count on what that means for the average bill. The main thing you look at when you settle a rate case is the overall revenue requirement, and then, of course, how it specifically affects residential customers versus commercial versus industrial, et cetera, can vary from group to group. But the main focus right now has been on the overall revenue requirement and the overall terms of reaching a fair and balanced resolution.
So we'll find out more here in the days ahead as to exactly how much that we're going to basically save as an Indiana American Water Company utility customer. We're talking with Anthony Swinger, who's with the Office of Utility Consumer Counselor in Indianapolis. Small business owners in Northwest Indiana have a new advocate these days. He's Philip McCandies. He's the Regional Business Officer for the Indianapolis-based Community Investment Fund of Indiana. And he was with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about the fund and about its role in helping local businesses grow and thrive.
We are a nonprofit. We are, a CDFI, and we are literally just a micro lender. We're here to serve the community from the ground with the community and with the business owners that are working within the community.
Are they basically, a kind of a conduit between banks or other lending institutions and the businesses themselves?
Yeah, we want to be that partner with the banks and we want to be that partner with the community to usher them to the banks, because a lot of the time small businesses do not realize what the requirements are for banks, because banks look for specific requirements from specific businesses, and some just go at it in the dark, and they just had a little. If they had a little guidance, we could help them get there.
When you talk about establishing small businesses and the small business community in general, they're really a kind of a mosaic, aren't they, of what business is really like here. They're making up all kinds of different sizes of businesses, I guess, different types of people that are business people. They're not your cut and dried ones, are they?
No, they're not. We want to lend to the mission of each individual business, and we are mission driven. So we want to support the mission of each individual business in that unique way. So there might be some businesses that there are, for example, a couple businesses that came to me needing. At first, they thought they needed capital, but they actually needed social capital.
Uh-huh.
They needed to be put into place with the right people. They needed to put in. They needed a different marketing tool. They needed to be put to somebody that actually could introduce them to a bigger outlet for their product. So it always for us is always about getting the right type of capital to the client and to the entrepreneur in the community, which is not always financial. Which is what we like to provide, and we want to provide that. But some of them we do not want to overcapitalize and overfund. And a lot of the times that these good business owners in Northwest Indiana, a lot of times they just need a nudge in the right direction, a little encouragement. And some of them, two or three of them, were like, let me stop for the loan right now. I see what you did. And they made a couple of changes, and they didn't even need us. And I tried to get along to them.
Have you found, and this is probably the case all across the state for that matter too, that many of the small businesses that the Community Investment Fund of Indiana and your office that you work as a regional office here in Lake County in particular get to work with, are these folks that are people that they may be getting a business underway, maybe trying to help take over a business for a family member that maybe has passed on or just have turned over the business to somebody in the younger generation? And so that's why these are great people that are taking over business. They maybe know the business well, but they're not quite as skilled on the financial end of this. And this is why that they turn to people like you.
Yes, that's correct. A lot of the time when there is a business passed on, there is a somewhat of a financial taking from the person that is acquiring. That's just the business. And a lot of the time, those people will have either worked for the business or they're just, it may have been, you know, a medical condition or it just may have just been left in a will to them. And they want to just, you know, take it over for their parents and continue the legacy. For whatever reason it is, helping them get that education and get them the right technical assistance always comes back to not just our bottom line, but it also comes back to the bottom line of the community. We always want to be the CDFI for the city, so or the region or the state. We want our CDFI to be your CDFI. So if you need us and you come to us for resources about how to do your accounting, we want to be that resource for you. You know, we want to make sure we get you to the proper people in the area. So we're not just going to put one CPA over here because that might not fit how you do business. We will give you a host of CPAs that we've worked with in the area, and we will give you a list, and we would advise you to go talk to each individual one to help you with your business. And that, in turn, helps them run their business better, helps them create, you know, track their cash flow, and helps us create a proper loan package for them.
This is Philip McCandies, who's the Regional Business Officer for the Community Investment Fund of Indiana. And more information about the Community Investment Fund can be found online at capitalizingindiana.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, we have an at-length conversation with Lake Station Mayor Christopher Anderson.